After Biden and Putin's first meeting, is there anything for pundits to chew on? Aside from, you know, the obvious?
Joe Biden crossed his leg looking very comfortable, very casual. He's been coached on body language. Putin, of course, a master of it. You see him there sprawled out a little bit like he owns the place.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. New reports reveal the Justice Department seizing journalists' records again.
Right, nobody gets in trouble for talking about the Bin Laden raid. Hooray for America, we'll make a movie about it. What gets you in trouble is when you say they're waterboarding people in secret prisons or there's illegal wiretapping going on.
And a look back at a truly history-making case of our government guarding its secrets.
The public has no right to know secret documents, and freedom of the press is not the freedom to destroy the integrity of the government.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. According to historian John Ashley Soames Grenville, the first use of the word summit as a global leader meetup was in Geneva, the Cold War summer of 55. For the heads of the U.S., Soviet Union, Britain, and France, the meeting was an effort to break the ice on peaceful coexistence. Summit has been applied to such gatherings of global chiefs ever since, including thrice this week for NATO, the G7, and for Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin's first in-person chat, which, like the summit of 55, was in Geneva in uneasy times. Biden went on the record in an ABC News interview.
You know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly.
Sanctions have been levied and diplomats expelled.
The United States on Thursday announced sanctions punishing Moscow for alleged cyber hacking, election interference, and other malign acts.
A buildup of Russian forces along the border with Ukraine is reportedly setting off alarms for the U.S. and its allies.
Russia now kicking out 60 American diplomats from Moscow and shutting the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg.
A ransomware attack that shut down the country's largest gasoline pipeline was most likely the work of Russians.
This summit was a classic icebreaker. That's all it was expected to be. Pundits were left with little but body language to pick over when the doors closed.
What do you make of the little things we've seen so far, the way they shook hands, the fact that they both showed up on time?
Even the way that Joe Biden crossed his leg, looking very comfortable, very casual. He's been coached on body language. Putin, of course, a master of it. You see him there sprawled out a little bit like he owns the place.
Biden is way more concentrated on Putin. We see him quite eager. His balance is well forward.
After the doors opened, each president held separate press conferences. When asked about Russia's human rights record, Putin showcased his signature moves, deflections, and whataboutisms.
Look at the American streets. People are getting killed there, including those who are leading the various political organizations. You can get a bullet in the back of your neck. A woman just ran away from the police and they shot her in the back.
But we admit it. We're working on it.
But take Afghanistan, shooting from a drone. At an unarmed crowd. Clearly, the civilian crowd. How would you call that? Who is the killer now?
Well,
The Guantanamo prison is still operating. It doesn't even start to resemble what is stipulated in the international law or in the U.S. legislation. And yet it exists.
Well, there are still 40 people there. But is Putin actually saying that American failures give him carte blanche? President Biden opened his presser by suggesting the meeting had been overhyped, that it was merely the start of a dialogue on vital issues. And he expressed cautious positivity, a tone one reporter seemed to, well, overhype.
Why are you so confident he'll change his behavior, Mr. President?
I'm not confident. What do you do all the time? So when did I say I was confident? I said what will change their behavior is if the rest of the world reacts to them and it diminishes their standing in the world. I'm not confident of anything. I'm just stating the fact.
Alexei Kovalyov is the investigative editor at Medusa, an independent Russian news outlet. And he noticed that after the meeting, Putin did something unusual. He said something nice.
He said it was a very instructive meeting, that despite the impression that some media are giving about him, Joe Biden is a professional and he's very informed, and that even if he consults some cheat notes, as yesterday, Russian state media were quick to point out, Putin said it's nothing unusual and we all do that. He was unusually friendly. From the looks of it, Putin is eager for at least some improvement in relations with the United States because, well, we really can't go on like this for too long.
You saw some familiar tropes in Putin's presentation. Whatever Russia is doing is because the U.S. did it first.
I wonder if he realizes how insane that actually sounds. Whether it's the Guantanamo or whether it's the George Floyd protests or police brutality in the United States, the essence of it is always the same. So you don't have the moral authority to criticize us because look at yourself, things are as bad or probably even worse.
And then there's something that the U.S. population has become very familiar with, which is the, you know, uncontested lie.
Yes, that's one of his tricks up his sleeve. In the same league as turning up hours late. That's just his way of not trying to convince you of something, but of just showing you your place.
It's an exercise of power. What did you think of Biden's presentation?
Well, the optics of not allowing Russian press to the press conference wasn't good. And of course, the Russian press quickly latched onto this and criticized Biden for, so what about your famous freedom of speech thing, et cetera, et cetera.
Why do you think that Biden excluded the Russian press?
Maybe the logic was that why invite the press that's all controlled by the government when you can just talk to the guy himself? If that indeed was this thinking, then it's getting uncomfortably close to what Putin himself thinks of the press. He clearly doesn't believe in a free press. And it's evident when he sits down for a one-on-one interview with a foreign journalist, which he would never do in Russia with an independent media. I mean, was Medusa, there is no chance in hell we'll ever get a sit-down interview with Putin. The Kremlin won't even acknowledge our existence. They scrubbed all mentions of Medusa from the Kremlin's transcript of the interview with NBC's Keir Simmons.
While we're on the subject, you were designated by Russia as a foreign agent. What does that mean for Medusa?
From now on, we have to, on pain and a very huge backbreaking fine, put a massive, ugly legal disclaimer on top of everything we publish. And that includes all ads and promotional materials. And of course, that scared away 90% of our advertisers and it ruined our business model. We launched a crowdfunding campaign, which helped us stay afloat for a few months more. But now our sources are also afraid to talk to us for fear of being associated with a foreign agent. Our freelancers are reluctant to work with us. And that creates a whole new set of problems which haven't existed before. I mean, we are the first independent media outlet to be designated a foreign agent. So we are in uncharted waters. We don't know what's going to happen next. But, I mean, it's not really looking good. And that was the plan. That was the design, to slowly strangle independent media out of existence.
So how did the Russian press deal with Putin at his press conference?
Pretty much the same as they would at any regular press conference. You know, just throw him these softball questions. Pretty much the same that the Russian press criticized the Americans for.
What was notable to you about the performance of the American press in dealing with Putin?
So there was a lot of what I would call soundbite theatrics, where the act of asking the tough question is more important than getting the actual answer, because if you've been following Russia long enough, you know that what the answer would be. So it came from ABC's Rachel Scott, who asked Putin, the list of your political opponents who are dead in prison, don't jail this long, what are you so afraid of? But of course, Putin would deflect with a long diatribe about BLM protests in the United States or something. So I don't think it was very informative in terms of getting actual answers from Putin, because he's not there to do that.
But something stood out for you, not during the actual press conference, but remarks by NBC's Keir Simmons after his interview with Putin.
Keir said that after the interview, which lasted for 90 minutes, Putin stayed for almost an hour and he leaned in and he was really trying to persuade Keir that America is actually buying up all the Russian opposition and trying to unseat him through regime change efforts. And something that really shines through all his bluster, his actual fear.
So you think he means it?
He does. And I think all of Russia's recent domestic policies are a reflection of that.
He was trying to talk to Keir Simmons because he saw Keir Simmons as a representative of the U.S.?
Oh, yes, that's very evident from the answers he gave Mr. Simmons. And Simmons was always trying, but I'm just a journalist. I have no influence on the U.S. policy. But, you know, Putin wouldn't take any of that. I mean, he's quite convinced that the way the press works in the United States is the same. And not just the press, the civil society, everything. Because he's been president for 21 years now. That's the way it's always been with him. Literally, the first thing he did was bring all the big business and the media and the civil society to his heel. Because he saw free press and independent market as agents of chaos. And he's convinced that everyone sees them as such. And he thinks that the U.S. press is just as subservient to the president's office as the state media in Russia. And that's why he's talking to foreign journalists as ambassadors of their governments.
When he was asked about cyber attacks, he said that the U.S. has a huge cyber offensive program, which is true, and that Russia has hardly any program at all. How do you make progress on those issues if you don't admit you have those issues?
I think there's a difference between what Vladimir Putin says in the public and what his aides and ambassadors and diplomats back-channel back to the Americans. So if the American side presented incontrovertible evidence of Russian hacking into American networks, and if the Russian side admitted it through back-channels, they would never do it publicly. Yeah, but probably in maybe a few months or a year, the intensity of cyber attacks will quietly go down. And that's how we'll know that this summit was a success. They'll never want to be seen as caving into someone's pressure.
A lot of people have said this meeting shouldn't be receiving so much attention, that it's just legitimizing Putin, it's platforming a dictator. I'd push back on that. This is the U.S. president and the Russian president. I mean, they should meet, right? What do you think?
Well, of course they should. I mean, there's no way around that. No matter what we think about Putin, he's the president and he's going to be for any foreseeable future. So we got to work with what you have. After all these years of this craziness, I'm actually very cautiously relieved. What happened at this meeting and the summit and the Putin's remark after the summit, I'm kind of egotistically hoping that if the relations with the United States improve somehow, maybe it's going to be a relief for us here, for independent media and a civic society, because we are being punished for the state of relations between the United States and Russia, despite us not having any say in it.
Alexei, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was very interesting and illuminating conversation, unlike President Putin's press conference.
Alexei Kovalyev is the investigative editor at Medusa. Coming up, presidential missteps on press freedom. Yesterday, 50 years ago, and 60 years ago, here, there, and everywhere. This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%.
All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As President Biden tried to bring down the temperature in Geneva this week, a long-standing argument over press freedom was boiling over in Washington.
Leaders from CNN, The New York Times, and The Washington Post will meet with Attorney General Merrick Garland today. The meeting is set to discuss a controversial Trump-era leak investigation. It comes after revelations that Department of Justice officials saw 2017 phone and email records from reporters at all three media outlets.
Eight reporters were targeted, and we don't yet have an official reason why, but we can guess. In 2017, The Washington Post and The New York Times were each reporting out stories that involved leaked classified documents. Under Trump, the DOJ went looking for the newsroom sources and hit a dead end. But in 2020, then-Attorney General William Barr restarted the probe, this time filing subpoenas for the journalists' email and phone records, and issuing gag orders so the news organization's lawyers couldn't tell the staff that they were targets. 2021 brought a change in command, but initially no change in policy. Under Biden, the DOJ continued fighting in court to obtain phone and email records for reporters at the Times. In March, it issued yet another gag order. But this month, both the gag and the quest for records were dropped, and the new president expressed scrupulous regret.
It's simply wrong.
So you won't let your Justice Department do that?
I will not let that happen.
While conceding some mildly exculpatory ignorance.
It's an independent Justice Department. They will proceed, of course, with a range of investigations, which, as we noted in our statement on Saturday morning, we did not know about the gag order until minutes before the reporting came out on Friday night.
The tension between government secrets and a free press have spanned multiple decades and administrations. And Matt Apuzzo, an international investigative reporter for The New York Times, is no stranger to being caught in the middle. Matt, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much for having me here.
What do you make of the White House spokesperson Jen Psaki's response that the DOJ is an independent body, that the Biden administration itself didn't even know it was going on for a while? I think she said that. And we condemn Trump for using the department as his own private goon squad. She didn't say that. Should we slam Biden for a lag before pulling the brake?
I don't really care. I'm not into this for politics. My colleagues and I went through this under the Obama administration. The Obama administration used the Espionage Act in unprecedented ways to go after people. That administration completely trampled on the rights of a free press. So this is a bipartisan strategy here.
The incident you were directly involved in under the Obama administration, that was back in 2013. You were at AP, and you and reporter Adam Goldman broke news about an Al-Qaeda-affiliated bomb plot in Yemen.
We revealed that there was an active plot, that the government knew about it, wasn't telling people that there were active threats to travel, threats to the homeland, and that this was a very live plot with a sophisticated new type of bomb. They initiated an investigation and they seized our phone records without any sort of ability to argue in court that that was an overreach. I would love to say that we were the only ones that happened to, but unfortunately, the Obama administration made a habit of going after reporters and going after people who talk to reporters. And so the rules that dictate how the Justice Department should handle these sorts of things changed under Obama administration.
In his second term, these incidents dropped off.
Yeah, and the idea was that there should be a higher bar when the government comes for reporter work product, and that reporters ideally should get a chance to argue in court that this is an overreach. And then the administration changed, and we went right back to square one.
Go back one more administration to George W. Bush. The DOJ was very aggressive with national security reporters, jailed Judy Miller, a Times reporter, for 85 days for refusing to reveal confidential sources regarding CIA operative Valerie Plame. This is not partisan. I'm just wondering, leak investigations, seized records, gag orders. We all know that this is going to have a chilling effect, but have you ever experienced a likely source backing off because of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, you can never know why somebody doesn't want to talk to you, but I can absolutely tell you the chilling effect is real. It is not a theoretical thing, and that is precisely why it gets done. It gets done to tell people in the government that they're going to get caught if they step out of line. Because let's remember, what gets you in trouble in Washington is not talking about classified information. What gets you in trouble in Washington is talking about stuff that makes the government mad, right? Nobody gets in trouble for talking about the bin Laden raid. Let's tell the whole story in every detail about the most highly classified operation ever. We'll make a movie about it, right? Well, CIA will participate. What gets you in trouble is when you say, actually, you know, they're waterboarding people in secret prisons, or there's illegal wiretapping going on, or the government's collecting everybody's phone records in America. They hide under the guise of it's classified. Even though everything in this government is classified, the intention is to scare people off of talking to reporters. That's the goal, so that the only information that gets out is the officially blessed version of the story.
You'd been through this before. How was it for you when you found out about this latest incident?
We had seen that the government had come for the Washington Post, and we'd seen that they'd come for CNN. So when they said, oh, yep, you guys too, it wasn't a huge surprise, but obviously it was really upsetting. And the real thing that was upsetting, Brooke, is that this is career law enforcement people weaponizing really anti-American, anti-press rhetoric. When the president of the United States says the press is the enemy of the people, and he points to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN, and then prosecutors go and get a secret order to start rummaging around in email accounts and in phone records, that should be troubling to anybody.
Do you think that some of your sources and those of other reporters have been revealed during this process?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know at this point what they have, what they intend to do with it. I sure as hell think they should give back what they have and destroy copies. But first, we need to know what the heck happened. We need a reckoning to know, were the rules followed? The rules are pretty clear that this has to be signed off on by the Attorney General and the head of public affairs. So let's just see the chain of command. Let's see if the policy worked.
What do you do to prevent your records becoming vulnerable? Do you use encryption procedures that offer some protection to a source?
Yeah, of course. I mean, everybody has encrypted apps on their phone now, and you try to do your meetings in person, and for sensitive stuff, leave your phone at home. But look, here's the thing. Reporters aren't spies, and we shouldn't have to be. We're not doing anything wrong. We're trying to tell the story of our government, and that's important. We can all take precaution, but it's naive of us to think that I, sitting at the New York Times with my phone and an encrypted app, am going to defeat the most sophisticated and best-funded intelligence gathering operation in the history of mankind. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
What would satisfy you, Matt? Assuming that there are sometimes, rarely, occasions where a reporter or a source may overstep and actually threaten national security,
two things on that. First, I just want to push back on this idea that harming national security is somehow a standard, because looking at everything we know about the way the government has conducted itself since 9/11, about drone strikes, about secret prisons, torture, abuses at Guantanamo Bay, abuses at Abu Ghraib, wireless wiretapping, everything we know was under this guise of, if you reveal it, you're going to harm national security. So if you took that off the table, what would you know about what the government does to keep you safe? You would know nothing. They always say, if you print the truth, it's going to harm national security. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would push back on is, when I talk to my kids, when something goes wrong, I get you're sorry. And I get you promise you're never going to do it again. But first, I need to understand what happened. So you asked me what would satisfy me. I'm much more interested right now in understanding how this went off the rails than I am trying to envision what are we going to do. Because we can't ask the question of how are we going to fix it until we know what happened.
So what's that missing piece that's getting at you?
Where did the idea for these subpoenas come from? What were they looking for? Who proposed it? Who authorized it? Were the internal procedures followed? Why did the government argue behind closed doors? We couldn't possibly tell the reporters that we wanted to see their phone records. We couldn't possibly let them come to court because it was a big secret. Why was that allowed to be said when there's an article, I think on the front page of the New York Times and elsewhere, saying there's a leak investigation going on into these stories? I just want to know. And I know the inspector general is investigating this. And I know, obviously, the fact that members of Congress and their families also had records seized on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of this. Look, nobody is arguing the government doesn't have a right to protect its own secrets and to conduct internal investigations. They have huge power to do that internally. They can go through people's phone records. They can do polygraphs. They can pull security clearances. There's no shortages of tools that they have at their disposal. What I don't understand is why this all-powerful intelligence apparatus that has cropped up in the last 20 years suddenly hits a dead end and is really interested in going through my news-gathering materials. So wherever we end up, I'd be pretty happy to have that line be a little clearer.
The implication is that they don't need journalists to find this stuff out, so they're doing it for another reason.
Yeah, they're sending a message that if you write stories we don't like, there's always a risk of consequences. It's as much a message for me and my colleagues as it is for everybody who works in the government. And again, there's no surprise that the news organizations that they came for were the Washington Post, the New York Times, and CNN, given everything that the former president was saying about those news organizations almost on a daily basis.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Matt Apuzzo is an international investigative reporter for the New York Times based in Belgium. At some point, every American president tangles with an unruly press. The hard-boiled surveillance campaigns Apuzzo described are not particularly novel. But no president, other than perhaps the last one, conjures up media fear and loathing more than Richard Nixon, who told his foes they'd be sorry when he was gone.
Just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
That was him in 62, freshly a sore loser of the California governor's race, berating 100 journalists at what he called his last ever press conference. 6 years later, Nixon was a presidential candidate, desperate not to lose again, and to ensure he wouldn't, he did something that, according to the new podcast, Nixon at War, would forever haunt him. Kurt Anderson, host of Nixon at War, says the need to protect that secret escalated Nixon's paranoia when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers in 1971, prompted the infamous Watergate break-in in 72, and ultimately ushered in Nixon's bitter end. Welcome to the show, Kurt.
I couldn't be happier to be here with you, Brooke.
So the Nixon years have been litigated over and over again, but your innovation is you make it feel more intimately knowable. I want to play a clip from episode 2, wherein President Lyndon B. Johnson talks about then-presidential candidate Richard Nixon's meddling in Vietnam War peace talks in 68. On a Saturday night, Johnson calls Senate Minority Leader Republican Everett Dirksen. Johnson calls what Nixon is doing treason. Dirksen agrees, but Johnson says he's not going to call it out.
Now, I know who's doing this. I don't want to identify it. I think it would shock America if a principal candidate was playing with a source like this on a matter this important.
Yeah.
I don't want to get in a fight with him there. I think Nixon's going to be elected.
Yeah.
But I know this, that they're contacting a foreign power in the middle of a war.
It's a mistake.
And it's a damn bad mistake.
Oh, yeah.
So what was Nixon up to in 68?
If not treason, it was certainly wrong, illegal. It was a violation of the now somewhat famous Logan Act, which prevents American citizens from doing exactly what candidate Richard Nixon was doing, which is to say, using his agent to keep telling the South Vietnamese president and regime, our allies, to not go along with this peace breakthrough that Lyndon Johnson had just crafted because it would help his vice president, Nixon's opponent, Hubert Humphrey, win the election.
You mentioned Nixon's agent. To scuttle the peace talks in Paris, he enlisted the help of Anna Chenault, a former Chinese journalist and a prominent Republican. Of course, Nixon denies it. And here, your team dug up a previously unheard clip from the famous interviews of Nixon by British TV host David Frost.
There have been a lot of reports that Madame Chenault was in touch with President Tu via the Vietnamese embassy, urging him to take a firm line because he would get better terms, better support from you than from a Democratic president and so on. Did you ever hear about that?
I'm hearing about it from you today, and I would do nothing to undercut them. I did nothing to undercut them. I couldn't have done that in good conscience.
What did you learn about Anna Chenault in the course of making this podcast? How pivotal was she?
Absolutely pivotal. And she's an extraordinary character. This teenage war correspondent who meets this famous U.S. Air Force general during World War II, marries him, comes to the United States, he dies, and she becomes this right-wing, anti-communist power broker and Nixon's biggest female donor. That's how she was referred to at the time. And was big pals with the South Vietnamese ambassador to the United States, whom she introduced to Nixon. And in that introduction was named by Richard Nixon to be his sole emissary as a candidate to South Vietnam to make sure they didn't go along with this peace breakthrough if it came to be.
You see his sabotage as kind of the first domino. It certainly did seem to be of a piece with what followed later. I mean, right up until when the Pentagon Papers were published. And they weren't even necessarily bad for Nixon, since they were about prior administrations. In fact, you share what Kissinger told Nixon on the day they were published.
No one reading this can then say that this president got us into trouble. I've read this stuff. We've come out pretty well in it.
So why did they trigger Nixon to order a break-in?
There was a secret file that he thought the Brookings Institution, the big liberal think tank, had that would prove and show all of his dirty deeds about the peace talks to get elected.
Get it done. I want it done. I want the Brookings Institute safe, clean, out.
Days and weeks later, have we taken care of Brookings? Have we done that? Did we get the men there last night? Part of the plan at one point had been to also commit arson there as a diversion from the burglary they were going to commit. Never took place. But this is the moment at which the plumbers, as they were called, these burglars, were really given carte blanche to do whatever it takes to find out what secrets the Democrats had or anybody else who he saw as his enemy.
You say all roads lead back to Vietnam for Nixon?
All of the paranoia and fascination with secrets that led him to do the Watergate burglary and then the cover-up really started back here when, in 1971, right after the Pentagon Papers, when he was ordered the break-in of the Brookings Institution. And then before that, in this really covered-up, dismissed story of Anna Chenault and dealing with Vietnam and using and justifying to himself any means of national security, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, whatever, for political reasons, was justified because we're fighting a war. One of the great tragic ironies is that way too slowly, but the war was winding down. Fewer American men were being drafted. We were pulling out. And yet he couldn't let it alone. It drove him mad. Vietnam and the politics of Vietnam and the liberals are against me and the press is against me and all of that, that really sent him off the rails and right into Watergate and his downfall.
He also exploited a kind of organic political fissure between middle America, the silent majority, and the so-called elites. He literally pit hard hats against hippies.
A bunch of construction workers in Lower Manhattan attacked a bunch of protesters a few days after the Kent State killings. And then that became a thing. Construction workers marched day after day after day in favor of the Vietnam War and this America love it or leave it stuff. Starting in 68, more softly, this was part of his pitch, us normal Americans versus the professors and the liberals and the hippies and the protesters and the black people. And then he gives this speech at the end of 1969, just after there had been these massively successful anti-war protests called the moratorium. He gives this speech, famous silent majority speech, in which he doubles down on that.
I would be untrue to my oath of office if I allowed the policy of this nation to be dictated by the minority who hold that point of view and who try to impose it on the nation by mounting demonstrations in the street.
And we really are, in a way that I had never fully realized, living with the residual effects of Richard Nixon's making as his central political pitch what is now the central political pitch of the Republican Party.
Nixon famously loathed the press.
They're running the line, Chuck, of right to know. That's, of course, a goddamn code word, right to know. The public has no right to know secret documents.
In the speech Richard Nixon gave, for instance, in 1962, when he lost the governorship of California, it's a many, many minutes long aria about why the press hates him. And it's all about Alger Hiss.
For 16 years, ever since the Hiss case, you've had an opportunity to attack me. And
Richard Nixon made his name as a freshman congressman, persecuting and then prosecuting former communist Alger Hiss.
He was also a kind of upper crust patrician type that would have especially rubbed Nixon the wrong way.
100%. No, he was this Ivy Leaguer who the liberals and the newspapers loved. And then, you know, Danny Ellsberg, a different kind of guy, but also an Ivy Leaguer, Jewish. And although Richard Nixon had many Jewish people working for him, was famously, and we have tapes galore to testament to this, a raging anti-Semite. And he just saw this as the same thing all over again. The press loves Ellsberg. Ellsberg's a fink, you know, just like Alger Hiss was. He just keeps saying, no, 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 this is how he did it with Alger Hiss. We ruined him in the press. We've got to ruin Ellsberg in the press. He rode Alger Hiss into political success and rode his idea that it was happening again with Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers and then Watergate right out of office. If you were doing this as a movie, as a novel, it's a little pat, but that's exactly what happened.
What was the most surprising thing that you learned from producing the podcast?
Kissinger really is the other major character in this story. And just the sense of them and their relationship that one gets in this audio way that you don't get from text. It's not the same. After Richard Nixon gives a speech late in the game in 1971, the anchors on television are saying he did okay and spends the whole night getting call after call after call from various employees, friends, donors, sycophants saying, oh, you were great, you were great, you were great. And then starts worrying, like, this person didn't call. Why didn't this person call? So Henry Kissinger keeps calling back.
Here's a speech that we can all be proud to have had the privilege to be associated with.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way.
It is.
Well, it's a goddamn good little speech.
It was also magnificently delivered. It was the best delivery.
This sense of the Nixon whisperer, Henry Kissinger using this guy as he himself was being used by him, it's not a new revelation, but I would say that my sense of that is now deeper than it ever was.
Kurt, thank you very much.
Brooke, thank you. A longtime fan, first-time guest.
Kurt Anderson is author of Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History, and also the host, writer, and co-producer of the podcast Nixon at War from PRX. Coming up, most of us know the end of the story of the Pentagon Papers. Next, we return to the beginning. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. When it comes to peeling back the curtain on White House Wizards of Oz, journalists can come across as heroes, or at least gritty crusaders for the First Amendment, as in the 2017 Steven Spielberg film The Post, about the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers.
Ben, how are we supposed to comb through 4,000 pages?
They're not even loosely organized.
The Times had 3 months. There's no way we can possibly
He's
get
right.
this He's
right. We got less than 8 hours.
Hey, for the last 6 years, we've been playing catch-up, and now thanks to the President of the United States, who, by the way, has taken a all over the First Amendment, we have the goods. We don't have any competition. There's dozens of stories in here. The Times has barely scratched the surface.
But getting and publishing the papers and the subsequent trial was the end of the story. How about the beginning? Back in 2018, I sat down with Les Gelb, who was a 30-year-old Defense Department official when he was put in charge of compiling the papers by then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. And he told me how those papers came to be.
We got a list from McNamara of 100 questions.
Things like what's happening in the field, how many of the enemy died.
That's right. What's the body kill? 8 of the 100 questions were historical. And I was given 6 people to work on these questions, and we were given 2 months to get them done. By the way, we were told not to tell anybody about this. We stared at the questions, and we all started laughing. They said, well, why are we doing this? This is the kind of stuff we send up to the press secretary when we're preparing him to answer questions. And we're not going to be able to add anything to what we're doing on a daily basis.
But some of the questions were bigger than that. The questions included, are we lying about the number killed in action?
Yeah.
Can we win this war?
Yes, and those were the daily questions.
Real answers to those questions would take a lot more than a soundbite from a press secretary.
Well, we were giving what we thought were the real answers to the questions when we did the press guidance for the press secretary.
So how did the government feel about the war?
I would say almost everybody in the government felt that the war was not going well, but a number felt there were ways to fight it better. There were very, very few people in the Pentagon or the State Department or the White House who were flat out against the war.
Right. They believed in the domino theory.
Essentially, that was it. We're all brought up in that tradition of the domino theory. That somehow if we lost a strategic place such as Berlin, we would lose Europe. And in fact, in one of the memos you'll see in the Pentagon Papers, the State Department referred to Indochina as the Asian Berlin. That's how central they thought it was to the future security and safety of the United States. Hard to believe, but that's what we thought.
But why did McNamara ask you these questions if you were already given the best answers you could to the press secretary every day?
To this day, I don't know. McNamara initially just said, answer those questions. Then after this group of 6 that I had assembled schmoozed about it for several days, we decided, well, you know, it might be interesting if we could look back into the files and maybe give more in-depth answers to the questions we had been answering more or less from our daily experience. And inevitably, you had to dip back into the history. We wrote up a list of about 20-some-odd monographs.
Short papers.
That's really what the Pentagon Papers is, a bunch of short papers. I sent the memo to McNamara, and he wrote on that memo, okay, let it be encyclopedic, and let the chips fall where they may. But the only ones who really knew were CIA, because McNamara called the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, and Helms shipped over to me an enormous quantity of these documents from the CIA. But he never called Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State. He never called Walt Rostow, the National Security Advisor, or told Lyndon Johnson. The notion that this was a definitive history is just plain wrong, Brooke, because we didn't have that kind of access. And we never were allowed to do any interviews.
How long did it take?
A little over a year and a quarter. Started in June of 67, finished in February 69. And when it was all done, you know, we had these 36 volumes, which very few people who have written about the Pentagon Papers, I assure you, have read. And then I took the papers over to McNamara's office at the World Bank. He was head of the World Bank in February 69. I brought him into his office, and we're sitting around this coffee table having a little chat. And then finally I said to him, would you like to see the papers? I opened up one of the boxes, handed him one of the monographs. He flipped through it like you flip through a deck of cards with his thumb, and he threw it back into the box, and he said, and I quote, take them back to the Pentagon.
Do you think he ever read them?
I have no idea. I spoke to him many times over the years, and I never asked him, and he never said.
He was replaced by Clark Clifford as Secretary of Defense, blue blood lawyer who had virtually no foreign policy experience.
And we thought Clifford was sent to the Pentagon by Johnson to sit on people like us who had begun to ask questions about the war that the White House didn't like. Clark Clifford sensed this right away and laughed and said, you know, realize I've been against this war since 1965.
What did he think of the domino theory?
That was the reason why he became a dove in 65. Johnson had sent him to talk to the Asian leaders about sending more troops to fight the war. And none of them would give any troops. And so Clifford said, I thought to myself, well, if the dominoes don't think they have to fight to save themselves, what the devil are we doing?
By the time you were assembling what became the Pentagon Papers, it was already known to the Secretary of Defense and to the President that the war was not going to be won.
That's correct.
And yet they felt they had to continue to send battalion after battalion into the field to die.
No question about it. But, you know, I think most people by sometime in 68 came more to believe that we couldn't afford to lose.
They continued to send soldiers into it.
Not to lose.
To maintain a strange balance of power in the world. The domino theory. A bankrupt notion, as it later came to be believed.
But at the time, most people in government believed it. The story has been put out that the Pentagon Papers showed they were all lying. But while the papers show some lies, the main message is that our leaders, from Truman onwards, didn't know hardly anything about Vietnam and Indochina. They were ignorant. And it also shows that the foreign policy community believed that if we lost Vietnam, the rest of Asia would fall. Here we're talking about all this stuff, and you know far more than the average informed person about the Pentagon Papers, and you're surprised by my answers.
Precisely why we called you, Les, because there are legends about the Pentagon Papers, and you think that they convey a false narrative. Now, you concede there was an enormous amount of lying about numbers, constant statements of optimism. There was the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Yeah, what the American people were told in 1964 was that North Vietnamese boats attacked American ships in the Tonkin Gulf area, and that our ships fired back. But what I found out when I actually saw the negatives of the pictures taken during that night, these were negatives that showed our ships firing huge guns and no evidence of any small ships firing guns at us. I was astonished.
Confusion in the Gulf of Tonkin initially, and later outright deception, enabled President Johnson to effect a huge escalation in that war.
That's right. It provided the public justification.
I would argue that you may underestimate estimate the significance of the continuous lying throughout the conduct of that war.
I don't think I underestimate the lying. I know what it was, and I know who was doing it.
But you think the media narrative about it is outsized?
It's outsized based on the Pentagon Papers, Brooke. Ellsberg created the myth that what the papers show is that it all was a bunch of lies. But the truth is, people actually believed in the war and were ignorant about what could and could not actually be done to do well in that war. That's what you see when you actually read the papers as opposed to talk about the papers.
So essentially, a set of beliefs forced the government to continue to sacrifice in order to get the enemy to the table, maybe.
And Dixon negotiated for another 4 years or so before he concluded the deal.
And how many people died in that period?
As many as died in all the years before. And God knows how many lives ruined. And look, I wish I had turned against the war much sooner. And I regret it. You have no idea. But eventually I did, and then I spent several years of my life fighting against the Nixon policy and for the early end of the war. But it was too late.
So how did you feel back in 1971 when you discovered that the New York Times was about to publish the Pentagon Papers?
Well, that's a very good question, because to be perfectly frank, as I think I've been throughout this interview, my first instinct was that people would think this was the definitive history of the war, which they were not, and that people would think it was all about lying rather than beliefs. And look, because we never learned that darn lesson about believing our way into these wars, we went into Afghanistan and we went into Iraq. You know, we get involved in these wars and we don't know a damn thing about those countries, the culture, the history, the politics. And my heavens, these are not wars like World War II and World War I. We have battalions fighting battalions. These are wars that depend on knowledge of who the people are, what the culture is like. And we jumped into them without knowing. That's the damn essential message of the Pentagon Papers.
Les, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Yeah. You know, again, I don't deny the lies. I just want them to understand what the main points really were.
Les Gelb, former correspondent and columnist for the New York Times, former senior State and Defense Department official, former head of the Council of Foreign Relations, and compiler of the Pentagon Papers, died in 2019. And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Leah Feder, Micah Lowinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, Molly Schwartz, and Anthony Banzi, with help from Ellen Lee. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.